they're dropped in a sling, when they're being taken up from a boat and they're hurt, they don't fight back. We saw this again and again with dolphins that were hurt. They won't fight. The young ones, the very young ones, will attack. But then the older ones prevent that attack being damaging to humans. And they will punish in extreme way the young dolphin that tries to attack a human. So it's all set up to keep man from being injured. So one of the hallmarks of this, of their survival, is we've got to hang on until man learns, as far as I can make out. We've just got to keep hanging on to our ethic. And any dolphin or whale that breaks that ethic is automatically pushed out, kicked out of it. If the killer whales decided to be killer whales and kill men, our navies would probably eliminate them within a year instead of taking the 5 years you're going to take to eliminate them with a whaling industry. We've seen a lot of suicide. Since breathing is voluntary, they just stop breathing. So a mother was deprived of her baby, committed suicide, and a big male dolphin that was in the same colony prevented us from saving her, wouldn't let us get in and save her. So apparently they have an ethic that if an individual wants to commit suicide, they are to be allowed to. And if you can, you can turn that around and say, if the grief of a given dolphin is too great so that the rest of the group has to keep the sharks away and prevent the death of that dolphin, then that dolphin is expected to commit suicide. The hallmark of the big brain then, number one, adaptive programming. They change their programs depending on what you do. If you don't change your programs, they don't change theirs in any way that you can detect, because you're not ready to see them changing the program. So that in the ocean area, the performances tend to get very fixed. The dolphins give up after a while. They've spent several years trying to convince the trainers to do certain things by emitting certain sounds in air or certain performances in the water. And if the trainers stay out of the water and just throw in the fish and expect certain performances, the dolphins get very mechanical about it. This happened at Seaquarium. We used to take visitors over from our laboratory in Miami to the Seaquarium to see the dolphin shows, just to give them some background on this kind of thing. And it turned out that every time I showed up at one of these dolphin shows, the dolphins misbehaved and refused to go through the mechanical things and threw water all over the audience. And finally, the trainer asked me not to come and see these shows, or at least not to show myself to the dolphin. And we never could explain this, except that I used to go over, say, between shows and watch the training procedures and talk in the dolphin's presence and pet them and that sort of thing. And I don't know how they picked it up, but they said, apparently here's a renegade type and agree with this trainer, so we'll show him. This is the first time we went to see the killer whale show at SeaWorld. Exactly the same thing happened. The orca refused to perform until about the time the trainer gave up, and then suddenly he started performing again. Now the trainers ignore this. They call this misbehavior. I call it just intelligent attempt at communication, which is being ignored. So the assumptions, the simulations that one brings to one's work with the cetacea determine what one does and what one sees happen. Now, we found a long time ago that if we assumed the dolphins were stupid, that they would act stupid. They're very accommodating. If we assumed they were bright and adaptive, then they became bright and adaptive. This was explored by a woman at the Sea Life Park in Hawaii, Karen Pryor. Gregory Bateson worked in our laboratory in St. Thomas for about 18 months, then went to Hawaii. And he told Karen about some of these things, and she started rewarding new behavior. Gregory had the idea that learning to learn, due to a learning, was one of the capabilities of the dolphin, so that this could be demonstrated. So she started rewarding not the behavior that was expected, but any unexpected behavior, at which point the dolphins began to respond by entirely new behavior. Aristotle listened, and we listened. Two, so far, have listened. Two people.
That we know of, right?
But two people we know of have listened.
Recorded.
Everybody else starts making judgments about operant conditioning and, you know, bright animals and all this. Aristotle said the voice of the dolphin in the air is like that of the human, and they can pronounce vowels and groups of vowels, but he can't pronounce consonants. 400 BC. Now, the voice of the dolphin in the air, that's a weird one. The voice of the dolphin underwater is where the way they communicate. When do they make a voice in air? When they're around humans that have voices in air. And that's the only time. So, to the time of Aristotle, somebody who was working in ancient Greek with some dolphins. Now, dolphins given LSD, pure Xanthos, showed only two definite things. Imagine this room is a tank filled up near the ceiling with water. And that you're watching a dolphin that has LSD in him, swimming along the surface. You can tell right away that he has LSD in him. You know how? Those of you who've had psychedelics should be able to tell instantly. Let me give you the background. A dolphin does not believe what his eyes say. He believes what the echoes that he gets back with his sonar. As he swims along the surface, he suddenly does something he never does when he doesn't have LSD in him. He suddenly points his beak straight down at the bottom and turns on his sonar. And then he puts his beak back up and swims along the surface. And I instantly understood what he was doing. And I realized that this was, that what was happening was that his vision, where he could look at the bottom, is that the same thing happened to his vision that happens to human vision. With that dose of Xanthos. This was 100 and 200 micrograms, but it's pure Xanthos. Very different. And given intramuscularly. Okay, what's happened is that the bottom of the pool has disappeared for his visual field. So he turns on his sonar and gets the reflection of the bottom, and he says, okay, this is happening inside of me. Just like a person who's on acid sees the floor disappear. As they're walking across the floor disappears, and they stamp their foot, and the floor reappears. It's the same thing. That's the only thing that you can see in an ordinary dolphin. Now, we had one dolphin that had been spear gunned three times in the Flipper movies by Ivan Torres' people, who, in the 3 years that she stayed with us, wouldn't go near any humans. We gave her LSD, and she immediately approached us and stayed close to us as long as the LSD effect was taking place, and then left us again. As soon as it wore off.
Didn't you say the dolphin became affectionate to him?
Yeah. Well, approached us. In other words, climbed all over us. That's literally what it was. Her fear was abolished by the presence of the illness. So far as we can make out, all the dolphins that we ever gave LSD, and there were six of them, they all had good trips. Nobody had a bummer.
From what they could observe.
She got in and swam with them when they were under the influence. They were all over you. And they were all over one another. If she gave one dolphin the stuff, there was another one in the tank, that dolphin was all over the other dolphin.
Whether the other one had the LSD or not.
Right. This was all done back in 64 to 66 when it was legal to do all this. And we had full permission to give the dolphins LSD, so we did it. And then we recorded, very carefully recorded, what was going on. And we developed what's called a vocalization index. And we had ways of measuring this using a computer. So that as the dolphin, say you had a dolphin alone in the tank and you had 24-hour recordings of everything that that dolphin put out. Then you gave him, say, 100 micrograms, and you continued your recordings and then measured the vocal output and compared it to the vocal output without the stuff. And it turns out that the duty cycle, the amount of time spent talking, went as high as 90% from a baseline of about 10%. So in the presence of acid, they got very, very talkative.
Why LSD was given to the dolphins?
We had discovered years ago in 1954 that the respiratory system is totally voluntary. And we suspected that if we disturbed the cortical function and the thinking processes too much, that the respiration would fail. So we tried LSD to test this hypothesis, and it turned out that LSD did not muck up this system at all. They kept on breathing. We didn't need the respirator that we had ready. And so that the voluntariness of their breathing was so deep in the voluntary structure that we couldn't interfere with it. The human biocomputer, programming, metaprogramming the human biocomputer, has a chapter on interspecies interlock, which was derived from tank work. The first isolation tank that I had in the Virgin Islands was in the dolphin laboratory and used salt water. And the work with LSD from 64 to 66 was done in that tank with the dolphins right there. So if there is any possibility of a interspecies link by present unknown means, I've been exposed to it at least. That's all I can say about that.
More than anyone else, that's good.
Pardon?
And more than anyone else, I would think.
Rather intensively. Over a 2-year period isn't the minimum, right? So maybe my interest in dolphins is postulated on what the dolphins did to me when I was in that particular condition. I don't know.
This young young boy started writing letters to us, and then came by once to see us. And he told us one of the most fascinating stories about a love affair that he had with a dolphin over a 3-year period. And the thing that impressed me so was he's talking about realizing that the dolphin was going to be shipped out and he wasn't going to see the dolphin anymore. So he went to see her one night, and he was absolutely certain that the dolphin was giving him signals to go over to another tank because the dolphin was with another
her
dolphin.
Her boyfriend.
And so he got into the tank and he started swimming around with this dolphin. And he talked about finally figuring out a way to have intercourse with this dolphin. But the thing that really blew my mind was at the moment of his orgasm, he said there was no question that the dolphin was having an orgasm because it was a vibration that was going through the body of the dolphin, and then he had his orgasm, so it was just like a continuous orgasm. But he had to hold on to the dolphin while the dolphin went down to the bottom of the tank in the middle of this, right? So there was this unbelievable experience and trust in the dolphin at the same time. It was an unbelievable description of, and it wasn't sensationalistic, if you know what I mean. It wasn't that at all. He really developed a very, very close relationship with this dolphin.
There's a very good friend of Tony and myself who have, at the time, this was about 3 years ago, had a house on a beach in California, and the water, house was built out over the sand, and at high tide the water came right up under the house, under a porch. We were at a party at the house on Saturday night and slept in our van outside the house that night, and we were asked to come back in to breakfast in the morning. And as we walked into the house in the morning, the man involved came out of his bedroom and said, "I've just had the damnedest dream." He said, "I dreamt that I was down on the beach and with my dog walking along the beach, and this dolphin came in on the waves and beached itself. And then my wife came down out of the house and the neighborhood children, and they pushed the dolphin back out to sea." So at breakfast we all speculated about this, about my connection with dolphins and the fact that we'd been discussing dolphins the night before and so on. Within 2 hours, a dolphin swam in under the house and rolled around in the waves. And my friend and I were so shocked, we stayed up on the porch and watched while Tony and this man's wife went down with the neighborhood children, turned the dolphin around, and swam back out to sea.
It had beached itself.
It had beached itself, just as in the dream.
The same boy that I was telling you about that had the love affair with the dolphin, after about 6 months, the dolphin was taken away from that ocean area and take somewhere else. And in about 6 months, he was living with someone and had told that person that that night he'd had this terrible dream about the dolphin, but that the dolphin was not in the form of a dolphin, but it was a sort of gory dream with, you know, chunks of pieces of this dolphin. I think everybody can relate to one of those classic dreams of gory meat, you know, being sort of torn from a body. But he related this dream to this friend that he was living with. And do you know that very night that he had that dream, the dolphin that he had had the love affair with died? Now, what can we surmise from this? That there's perhaps some kind of communication that goes through the thought waves of people that are asleep. That's how Burgess probably got this message. I mean, it's a possibility. It's one that you could think of. And in the uncontained model, it certainly could be true.
You can get into a symbiotic relationship with a computer that has stored in it various useful types of programs. So what we'd like to do with the dolphins is to store teaching programs in a general purpose computer of small size, portable, which the dolphins can then elicit by their sonic and ultrasonic means, can elicit from the computer teaching programs which will teach them codes in order that they can further elicit new kinds of information from the computer. So they use the computer now not as a translator between human and dolphin, but as a teaching machine in which the dolphin is learning to manipulate with his sonic ultrasonic output within his normal range of frequencies, manipulate information storage systems which can then teach him further about those information storage systems and what's contained in them. So that you have an open-ended system in which the dolphin can also store information. And so you then can get into a very interesting problem if the dolphin does take off with this, as to how we can understand what's going on. And I think that would be an interesting way to check out the dolphin, quote unquote, intelligence. So that's where our present plans are, in the direct work with the dolphin, is the possibility of using our own input-output voice, their input-output voice, to reprogram one another and learn an intermediate language, and then by any means that we can work out, whether analog or digital or whatever, and then finally the checking out of the dolphins with the computer and having them trade off with the computer and learn a code and then learn programming techniques and then for us to record what happens and see if we can keep up with it.
You've been listening to Communication with Other Than Man. John and Antonia Lilly were recorded by Bill Cordham at NTNT in New York City. This program was produced by Linda Perry with special assistance by Billy Shapiro. Technical production by David Rapkin.